there could be multiple interpretations of what's going on. One could be that China's sort of beleaguered and challenged on multiple fronts because of these border disputes. Another interpretation is that China just as soon have some kind of a rheostat that it can dial up and down vis-a-vis China, Russia, Vietnam, because it actually doesn't want completely happy relationships with any of these countries, and it feels like it's in the driver's seat as the more powerful nation. And the degree of the border dispute is usually, you know, 10 kilometers here, 5 kilometers there. Again, not trivial if you happen to be one of the people who lives in that zone, but in the global scheme of things, not a big deal. No one's denying the basic right of the other country to exist or to exist more or less in its current shape and configuration. So you could call these major border disputes in the sense that there are a lot of them and that they involve powerful countries. You could also call them minor border disputes in that they don't involve a lot of territory.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 25th, 2019. Mike O'Hanlon is one of my most prolific and thoughtful Brookings colleagues. He writes on military affairs and foreign policy and has been a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution for a long time. His latest book is called The Senkaku Paradox, Risking Great Power War Over Small Stakes. The title says it all. It's about the places in the world that are the potentially most explosive flashpoints over the least important U.S. interests. It's about the places in the world where we are treaty-bound to go to war to protect trivia. And it's about thinking creatively about how to handle low-stakes questions in a high-stakes world. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 429, Mike O'Hanlon on the Senkaku Paradox. Let's start with the definition of terms. What is the Senkaku Paradox, and what is it named for?
Well, first, Ben, thanks for having me on this amazing show that you developed over the years that you've done so much with and that we've all admired and tried to emulate in our own way. The Senkaku Islands, to begin with that, are small islands in the East China Sea that both China and Japan claim. Japan technically administers them, but no one lives there and nothing happens there, so I don't quite know what that term means. But because the United States understands that Japan administers the islands, we have promised to help Japan defend them under the terms of the U.S.-Japan Mutual Security Treaty, our alliance with Japan, even though the United States has no position on whose islands they should be. And we don't actually necessarily commit to the idea that they should be Japan's. So that's how you have to understand the Senkaku Islands themselves before the Senkaku Paradox becomes evident in meaning. Because what the Senkaku Paradox means, as I've defined it, is that the logical extension of our commitment to help Japan defend them could lead to a U.S.-China war or a U.S.-Japan-China war over meaningless pieces of rock. In other words, following through on the logical requirements of the security treaty leads you almost to an absurdity. I could have called it the Senkaku absurdity, but certainly a conundrum for us, because if China ever did attack or grab or confiscate one or two or three or four of those eight islets, which aren't even big enough to qualify for their own economic zones under the Law of the Sea Treaty, by the way, because they can't sustain.
They're not real islands. They're rocks.
They're rocks. You could probably, if you were prepared to spend enough money ferrying supplies back and forth, you could sustain a human settlement there, which the Japanese did for a short time, I think in the 19-teens, like a fish smelting facility. But they had to bring in all the food, all the water. Like you say, it's jagged terrain. The combined land area is 3 square miles of all eight of them combined. So it's sort of like Gilligan's Island without the nice stuff. And and that's essentially what we could see war occur over, because Japan and China have both been pretty assertive in their claims, and they've come in contact with each other, including collisions with boats. So that's the signature sort of poster child for my book. But there's also scenarios in Eastern Europe that I envision that are similar in some ways, where Russia could not necessarily go for an entire annexation or invasion of an entire Baltic nation, but maybe just go for a sliver of one of those countries, Estonia or Latvia, for example, which are 25% Russian-speaking. And therefore, Vladimir Putin could extend his policy, which says he has the right to defend Russian speakers anywhere, and fabricate some kind of a disturbance just enough to send in his little green men to one of those towns in the eastern part of one of those countries, create a fait accompli, promise that he'll leave as soon as the disturbance has been solved, and then dare NATO to come push him out. And so that's the conundrum, again, the paradox that I'm trying to begin with.
All right. So let's, before we go into the specific scenarios that you describe, as well as the quite elaborated articulation of how we should think about this problem, let's talk about the issue that you just flagged, which is that the rocks in the East China Sea stand for a larger problem that is a spectrum of problems that go from the truly ridiculous, which is, you know, rocks that it's very hard to understand how the U.S. would have an interest in who administers them, to issues where we are deeply invested, right, in the relationship with the country in question. Estonia is a good example, but would you go to war over a small incursion into that country, right? We saw this issue presented rather acutely when the president made his comments about Montenegro, right, which
right.
I think this was after Helsinki, where he said, why would we go to war to defend Montenegro, which is, of course, a NATO member. So my question is, like, what's the universe of cases that you think of, the sort of universe of issues that you think of as encompassed under the idea of the Senkaku paradox? Is it a number of discrete issues, like specific land masses or rock masses, or is it a broader conceptual problem of, you know, how to deal with micro incursions against countries that we actually have deep relationships with?
It's more the latter. Another way to say it is it's where your world meets mine, if you will. You're thinking about cyber, digital, information warfare in a lot of what you've done with your operation here, as has my colleague Alina Polyakova over in foreign policy. The kinds of things that Russia's been monkeying around doing in various cyber domains, trying to affect electoral outcomes, you know, sort of aggressions short of classic military conquest, but still aggressions, just digital aggressions.
Right.
And these I'm talking about are more physical aggressions, but over tiny things, where the goal is not really what they're able to seize. The goal is the conundrum they put whatever alliance they've now attacked, the conundrum that alliance is now in, because the response isn't so obvious. Doing nothing doesn't seem very smart because it's an invitation to further probes, further attacks. And yet launching World War III doesn't seem commensurate or proportionate to the stakes. And so they've put us in a dilemma if they can figure out sort of how to do this attack. And, you know, it's probably not going to happen because it's probably not worth it to either of those countries, Russia or China, to risk a greater American and allied response than they might expect. But they do have incentives to consider this. For Putin, the incentive is to show that NATO cannot make a decision, that its 29 members would not agree on how to respond to this. And I'm quite sure they wouldn't. And that could then lead to existential questions in NATO. What's the alliance for if Article 5 doesn't mean anything, if NATO's prepared to watch a piece of territory of one of the 29 member states be taken by Russia and do nothing in response to directly liberate that territory, even though I personally wouldn't favor a direct military response to liberate a tiny probing attack. With the U.S.-Japan situation in regard to China, as we know, the history question is alive and well with Japan and China. They have not moved beyond World War II or the previous Japanese aggressions. The history question keeps coming back with the Yasukuni Shrine issue, with many other questions. And so for China, they still feel like Japan's insistence on holding onto these islands is proof that Japan has that latent militarism, that latent lack of sort of proper repentant feelings for what they did in the past. And it becomes a test case about whether Japan is becoming a more normal country. But for the Japanese, they look at it the other way and they say, China now is on the march. They're 10 times our size. This is just the first, you know, footstep or toe in the water. And if we give in here, a lot worse is to come. So there are just grander issues that can arise in either Europe or the Western Pacific with these kinds of little probing attacks. And it could include everything from a more severe cyber attack to a collision of military assets like ships at sea to the Chinese using a little bit of lethal force against the Filipinos over one of the islands that they dispute, even though the U.S.-Philippines treaty these days is in a little bit of a shaky status given the proclivities of President Duterte and his on-again, off-again interest in cozying up to China. Nonetheless, we are committed by treaty there, too, to the defense of our ally, which the Philippines still is, even though it's shaky at the moment. So there are a lot of scenarios, to answer your question finally more directly, that I think could come under this general heading of Russian and Chinese behavior that's unacceptable and yet not worth the risk of World War III.
So I'm fascinated by your comparison of it into the cyber domain, because we always think about the cyber domain. We're sort of looking for real world meat space metaphors for what's going on in cyberspace. And is this, a use of force, right? Is it an armed attack, right? And we're constantly looking for metaphors in the cyber domain to real world stuff. And this is the first time I have ever heard somebody analogize a physical world territorial aggression to a cyber attack. So I think it's actually a really just a side note. I mean, it's something you also mention in the book, but I think it's a really interesting maybe an issue where actually people are taking cyber behavior and migrating it back to real world or physical world behaviors.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, I think if you probably can gain insights about how to operate in one of these worlds by looking at the other and seeing where there have been successes in the other, and then figuring out or asking what would be the translation of that kind of an approach into the other space, from the digital to the material or geographical. And I'm always looking, as a simple-minded guy, I'm always a farm boy from Western New York State, I'm always looking for a way to find common terminology that doesn't make me reassess every new potential scenario on completely different terms. And I'm not sure if there's a single spectrum of aggression. Maybe there are two or three dimensions. But I do feel that when I describe some of the things you study and track in your work with Lawfare and more generally here in governance studies to the scenarios that I've spent most of my career worried about, they do sort of have an area of overlap in the set of actions by a China or a Russia that I would describe as, again, unacceptable, but not worth World War III. And
and yet at some level, we are treaty committed to something like World War III, at least in theory,
and the way that it's classically understood in the American national security community. I think your cyber world, your digital world, is aware of the need to be a little more creative. But in my world, partly because we're coming out of the Cold War and then we're coming out of the period of American unipolarity, we in the national security space tend to think of these treaties, which have a mutual defense clause, often Article 5 in both the NATO and Japan treaty, that say essentially an attack on one is an attack on all. And there is no parsing of what size attack invokes that clause. Once you have a territorial attack against an ally, it's as if New York City was seized by the Russians. And so the implication is, let's go all in. Let's not get too cute or too clever about which attacks merit a response. Let's operate from the assumption that anything merits a response. And in the Cold War, we saw this over, say, Berlin, where a city that was deep inside of essentially Warsaw Pact geography, but had been held onto in part by the West, was seen as a big case, a big test of resolve when the Soviets tried to sort of force us out a couple of times and we insisted on staying. So it was a small piece of geography, but it was seen as having huge implications. So I'm thinking in somewhat similar terms now today. In the Cold War, however, we chose to stand up for that, partly because real people live there. The scenarios that I'm thinking about in this book are primarily scenarios where real people don't live there or very, very few. So a Senkaku Island, uninhabited, a tiny farming village in eastern Estonia with 100 Russian speakers and 100, Latvian or Estonian speakers, essentially inconsequential in the grand scheme of things. You don't want to trade away those lives.
Yeah, though it does suck for them.
Yeah, right. Although actually the response by NATO might suck even worse than us finding a more indirect way, because the distinction for them at that point once deterrence has failed, as I've now premised in the book, the distinction is between having their town be a battleground in the physical space and having us use a more patient strategy that relies primarily on economic sanctions and warfare, which leaves them under Russian control for a while, but at least there aren't bullets and bombs flying.
So we're going to – I want to get to your strategy, but I have one more question just to set it up, which is on its face, this is not a new problem. You refer to the Berlin standoffs. The United States has had treaty commitments to countries that are on the front lines of the Warsaw Pact since the beginning of – since NATO was created. The Senkakus themselves have been matters of dispute forever, a similar length of time between China and Japan. So why is this issue arising now? Why are we thinking today but not 10 or 20 years ago about, you know, low stakes flashpoints creating high impact great power conflict?
It's a great question. Let me start with Russia. I think 10 to 15 years ago, Russia was only developing the chip on its shoulder that it now has in full force and full display every single day. And it wasn't until the second big round of NATO expansion and then the attempt to put Ukraine and Georgia in line for the next round, along with their membership in the EU, which again hasn't happened yet and may not ever, and they're also still not in NATO. But back in the 2007-8 timeframe, we were saying we wanted them in. That brought this whole issue of geography to a much higher level in Vladimir Putin's mind. And he realized that as we were promising NATO membership someday for Ukraine and Georgia, which happened at the Bucharest summit in 2008, that President Bush and Condi Rice had really pushed for. We were also saying at the time of the Bucharest summit in 2008, Ukraine and Georgia would be members. However, they could only be members if and when their boundary disputes with neighbors were resolved, which was a longstanding NATO policy in previous rounds of expansion. But of course, if you interpret it in a different light, which we frankly were not thoughtful enough to have anticipated, that becomes an invitation to Vladimir Putin that if he stokes trouble in one of these countries, they remain ineligible for NATO membership. Now, at the same time that Yeltsin's working harder and harder to keep former Soviet republics, especially Ukraine and Georgia, out of NATO, he's noticed that the three Baltic states, which of course were also former Soviet republics, are now already in NATO. He doesn't like that. He can't undo it, but he can make us nervous about the need to even consolidate our current size and status as an alliance and make us recognize that any further expansion, he's got multiple tools to mess with, both before, during, and after the expansion has occurred. So I think you have to see the Eastern European problem in light of the evolution of Putin's view about us, our goals, and his, therefore, necessary responses in his own mind. With China, it's different. It's much more about their rise. It's a much more linear extrapolation of where they were and where they're going and their newfound power, combined with the fact that the China-Japan relationship hasn't gotten better really in our adult lifetimes, which is sort of staggering. I think it was better when I first started studying this issue in graduate school than it is today. And so you combine those two factors, those two forces or trajectories. And it was actually only about 10 to 12 years ago that China decided to get assertive about the Senkaku Islands. It had sort of let that issue stay dormant as it had bigger things on its mind for the whole period of, you know, Mao and Deng Xiaoping and so forth. But now it's feeling its oats, looking for places to be a little more assertive, reclaiming islands in the South China Sea, demanding some fair share of the islands in the East China Sea. It's sort of become the way China is expanding and – or expanding its influence, I should say. It's not expanding its territory, and it's generally not shooting at people to do most of what it's up to. But it's trying to find coercive mechanisms to flex muscles, to have more influence in the region, and to push back against Japan where possible.
Two other hypothesized reasons in China's case. One is that the specific mechanism or one of the major mechanisms by which China's rise is expressing its power is this obsessive attention to what it considers its territorial seas that the rest of the world considers international waters. And so you have this very sort of acute focus on Scarborough Shoals and the sort of Philippines issues, Vietnam, and, you know, and the Japanese islands in the East China Sea. Second reason, curious for your thoughts on this, China has always had major border disputes with Vietnam, with India, with the Soviet Union. They did not involve U.S. allies, but you migrate that out to the territorial seas and all of a sudden, or the non-territorial seas, and all of a sudden you're dealing with the U.S. Pacific Rim, and that creates these flashpoints that would otherwise be sort of dormant, disputed territories.
Yeah. You know, there could be multiple interpretations of what's going on. One could be that China's sort of beleaguered and challenged on multiple fronts because of these border disputes. Another interpretation is that China just as soon have some kind of a rheostat that it can dial up and down vis-a-vis China, Russia, Vietnam, because it actually doesn't want completely happy relationships with any of these countries, and it feels like it's in the driver's seat as the more powerful nation. And the degree of the border dispute is usually, you know, 10 kilometers here, 5 kilometers there. Again, not trivial if you happen to be one of the people who lives in that zone, but in the global scheme of things, not a big deal. No one's denying the basic right of the other country to exist or to exist more or less in its current shape and configuration. So you could call these major border disputes in the sense that there are a lot of them and that they involve powerful countries. You could also call them minor border disputes in that they don't involve a lot of territory. And frankly, if China really wanted to solve some of them, it probably could. So I see, you know, China's, I think, a different kind of rising power than we've seen in history. In the old days, rising powers used to go out and look for their fair share of the spoils to conquest and to conquer. And the Europeans, of course, did this more than anybody. But even the United States did it, taking land from Mexico. And certainly the Japanese did it, trying to take land from Korea and China. And the Chinese are not going to do that, I don't believe, not in the same way, not with the same brutality, frankly. But they are displaying some of the characteristics of a rising power in history, which is wanting to turn that muscle, military machine, and testosterone into something tangible. And for them, it is these border disputes at sea or on land, and primarily at sea, because at sea, there are a lot of places where no one lives. But there may be economic resources that in some sense make it worth the trouble. There's also a defensive zone they'd like to create between them and the U.S. Navy or the Japanese Navy. And so, yes, I see China flexing muscle in primarily uninhabited border areas as its main manifestation of sort of rising great power behavior, which is both disturbing because they're doing a lot of it, but it's also in a potentially happier way less disturbing than what the European powers did in most of the last 500 years. And perhaps it indicates implicitly an agreement by them that they're not going to engage in classic interstate aggression, even as they look for more clever indirect ways to flex their muscle and get their fair share as sort of the number one rising superpower of the century.
All right. So that brings us to the question of what do you do about it? And if you take as a given, and I do, that there are things that you can imagine that, you know, in the way of territorial aggression, that you are not going to turn the amps to 11 for. And even if you wanted to, there would be no appetite among the other parties to the whatever the treaty regime is. In Japan's case, it's just us, but in a European context, it's NATO. And so you get this question of, okay, what does a strategy look like that meaningfully deters and meaningfully responds to an event once it's taken place, but also doesn't commit you to a nuclear exchange with some of the most powerful countries in the world over something that you, you know, something where you don't really have a dog in it other than, I mean, the treaty commitment is a dog in it, of course, but beyond the treaty commitment itself, that's kind of all you've got. So again, very similar problem to the cyber, you know, structurally to the cyber question, right? You can't keep them out of your systems. You can't, you know, you can do the best defense you can do, but eventually, if the Russians want to do something to your power grid or the Chinese want to steal your secrets, they can do it. So you're thinking about out-of-domain responses as well as inside-of-domain responses, and you want ones that are minimally escalatory. How do you think about it when it's a rock in the East China Sea?
The main thing I decided with the book is just to try to propose a change to how we think about it. The details matter less to me than taking on the conventional wisdom that the response should be primarily direct, symmetrical, and military. And so what I try to do in a good chunk of the book is actually think through the scenario in some detail or a type of scenario in each region and just explain why, beyond the stated, you know, paradox, why it really would be imprudent for the United States in an era when Russia and China have increasingly the kind of precision strike weapons that especially near their own shores and borders are going to be really effective against large military assets. That's a trend in warfare that's irrespective of where we are with Russia and China politically or even the digital domain. It's somewhat separate from it's the era that we saw arrive in Desert Storm in 1991, and now that's sort of spread to a lot of countries. And when you try to come into somebody's wheelhouse or neighborhood with big ships, with fixed airfields, it's going to be really hard to do this. And so I want to challenge the notion that that should be the first response. I also want to challenge the notion that the response should be primarily a DOD, Department of Defense activity or responsibility. Because as you know, the only places in the U.S. government where we do war planning are essentially the combatant commands of the U.S. military and then to some extent the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Joint Staff in the Pentagon, which integrates the different regional commands. We don't do war planning at the Department of Treasury. The way you apply sanctions, I think, as I understand the process, is the NSC or the president will say to Treasury, we want to, you know, gradually up the pressure on Iran or Russia or North Korea or whomever. Please think of another round of sanctions that would do that. But I'm talking about an integrated way of using sanctions with forward military deterrence, other tools of American foreign policy in a single overall response plan that might need to be applied quickly and fairly, you know, decisively at a given moment in time. But we don't have Treasury people out in the combatant commands in any numbers, or trade people, or CFIUS, Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, or National Science Foundation people who know which minerals we really depend on China or Russia for. And therefore, if they cut off, you know, supplies to us in retaliation for what we're doing to them, who's going to have escalation dominance? I just want to get the paradigm different than what it's been. The paradigm has been direct military response to liberate any and all allied territory using U.S. and allied military force. And what I think is we can be more patient in how long we have to reverse the aggression. We should be more clever, use the great economic toolkit that we've learned we have in these last few decades. The military part needs to be there, but primarily for forward defense against any further aggression. So if one of the Senkaku Islands were taken by China, I would want the United States and Japan to fortify the other seven. And I would want more of the Seventh Fleet to be based near those islands going forward. And I might even want a bigger Navy. I might want a bigger defense budget in order to be able to sustain that indefinitely. But I still think all that is preferable to taking the first shot against Chinese soldiers who are ashore. So that's the basic concept. It's a combination of forward military defense to prevent any worse snowballing of the initial aggression. Sort of isolate the cancer, you know, isolate the Chinese or Russian movement forward more or less in that initial place where it occurred, make it very hard for them to come further, and then use economic warfare to punish them and make sure that we are not so vulnerable to their economic retaliation that we lose that escalation. And then wait it out. Most of these, I think we can wait out, and we're better advised to wait them out than to feel we have to reverse them quickly.
So there's a huge amount there that I want to get into, but I want to focus first on your last point, wait them out. We're in a position to wait them out. I assume the reason we are in a position to wait them out, in contrast to, say, Iraq and Kuwait, is that these are uninhabited islands, right? That there's that you're actually talking only about situations where the stakes are genuinely low. What's the limit of this principle? Where would you say the traditional U.S. posture, which is we've got to go in and reverse the gain, the improper gain of the aggressive actor, which is the, you know, Desert Storm idea. This aggression will not stand. It's not. We're going to go forward, deploy, and use economic warfare and wait it out. What's the limit of the principle where you would apply this idea?
A major city in one of the Baltic countries. So, you know, anything more than a minimal border incursion. Or Taiwan. And I do have Taiwan scenarios in the book. As you know, Taiwan is not recognized as an independent country, and we don't have a formal U.S. diplomatic presence there. We no longer have an alliance with Taiwan, but we have a very strong commitment over the decades to Taiwan's safety and security. And the Taiwan Relations Act of the early 1980s says that we would come to Taiwan's aid in some way if they were attacked in an unprovoked fashion by China. So a blockade of Taiwan by China is the scenario that gives me the most heartburn. I don't think that China's going to try to invade Taiwan. It's just too hard. And amphibious assault in the modern era is just a very high stakes and high risk proposition. But a blockade, even a minimal leaky blockade that just tries to raise the price of shipping in and out of a country or an entity that depends on trade for 2/3 of its GDP, that's a hard one for us because then time is not on our side. And in that case, I believe that asymmetric military options against Chinese shipping in the broader Middle East region for oil would be our best additional tactic. So if China blockades Taiwan, again, the classic American plan has been go break the blockade because we own the seas vis-a-vis China. They couldn't compete with us in the air or the seas. And if China had tried to do this historically, we could have simply overwhelmed them with the technological excellence of our Air Force and Navy. But at this point, China's catching up. Technology is allowing more long-range precision strike. Even if you're not as strong as your adversary, if they're bringing big ships and, you know, planting big airfields near your territory, you can get through defenses with some decent probability and cause a lot of pain. So I want to shift the military action to a different theater, which is further from China, still far from us, but a place where we have the military infrastructure. And in a way, today's news, you know, with the developments in the broader Persian Gulf of Oman area, it shows the way in which this sort of operation could be envisioned. And I'm implying a systematic way that any oil tanker that's been willing to do business with China, that we would essentially prevent from operating in that broader Persian Gulf area. And ideally using non-lethal weapons to attack propellers and engines and things like that and not sinking ships and not killing crew. But in any case, focusing on a part of the Chinese economic lifeline where they have a greater dependency on foreign trade and also where we have a military superiority in the theater at issue.
So as I understand it, the limiting principle for where you would deal with it this way is size of the affected population.
I think that's primarily right, yeah.
All right, second question. And this will be of interest to Lawfare podcast listeners and perhaps nobody else except people in the Pentagon. So you're talking about an integration of projection of economic sanctions power with military power. And that raises the question of who is actually running that show, right? As a bureaucratic matter, are you talking about a Pentagon takeover of aspects of the Treasury Department? Are you talking about a Treasury Department takeover of military assets? Are you talking about running this stuff out of the White House? Or are you talking about the development, again, back to the cyber analogy, of something like CyberCom, right, which is an integration of NSA assets and capabilities with, you know, military authorities and the ability, you know, run as a combatant command? Like, what does it look like to do what you're describing? It's like Goldwater Nichols between cabinet departments.
It's really interesting the way you put it, Ben, because listening to you, you almost gave me a new idea that's not in the book. In the book, what I wanted was, first of all, to move more towards other agencies having greater influence and the Pentagon having at least marginally less. But the question then becomes, how do you do that? Because Treasury and Commerce and USTR and CFIUS don't have hundreds of analysts lying around waiting to just be sent up and stand up some new command that they have first dibs to, and the military is a support role for that. So in the first instance, what you're going to do, if you follow my ideas, is put some of these people from these other agencies, you're going to second them to PACOM, or Indo-Pacific Command, Central Command, European Command, and the Joint Staff in Washington. But then also encourage some of those agencies to develop their own red teams or war teams or planning teams at home agency. And maybe they do it with each other, the ones that are economically oriented, and just create one. What I don't want is just to wait for the crisis and then have the NSC do it. People always say, you know, let's have the NSC do it. That's where you integrate. But people also complain the NSC is too big and it thinks it's an operational arm of the U.S. government half the time in the modern era, and it shouldn't be. And also, the NSC is always busy putting out fires. And I want this to be done in advance. I want some options to be developed in advance against hypothetical scenarios, and then do some war gaming that involves the president and others, so they're at least starting in their own brains to get used to these ways of thinking. Because the actual crisis, the nature of the actual crisis that happens, of course, I can't foresee in detail, which is why I'm less interested. And actually, your wife was very good in a previous Brookings talk. She told me not to be too worried about sketching out each detail in advance, but to change the paradigm or to try to get people to rethink the paradigm. And then if one of these scenarios plays out, you're going to have to look at all the details to know what mix of tools. But you already want to have broken down the idea that DOD is by default the lead agency, that the essence of the response should be military. You want to break down those paradigms in advance, and partly for reasons of deterrence. So China and Russia know we have multiple options, but also to get people thinking the right way. So once the crisis happens, they're already mentally prepared, and they can already think about the tools and the toolkit. You know, military people already think, where are the carriers? Where are the bombers? You know, where are the special forces? I want people to have thought about, where are the sanctions on key high-tech sectors of the Chinese economy? Where are the financial levers? Where are the vulnerabilities in the United States that we got to start really protecting against even more, so that the toolkit's already in people's brains when the crisis strikes? And the last thing I'll say is that some people at DOD, when I've talked to them about this, you know, they feel like they'd be a little bit rude or impolitic to start bringing economic elements of government response into a war plan. You know, far be it from them to tread on somebody else's turf in that way. And I think there is a genuine humility and a genuine respect for the expertise of other agencies when most people have said this to me. However, they wind up in an oxymoronic place because they wind up with that logic only having lethal kinetic responses in the military domain to an aggression that just doesn't warrant, or an action by an adversary just doesn't warrant that. And so you're essentially solving every problem by, you know, you've got a hammer and that problem therefore has to be a nail. So by being so respectful of your colleagues and other agencies, you wind up underappreciating the leverage that they can bring to the problem. So I think we've got to break through that. We've got to break through those stovepipes. And maybe the idea you gave me is maybe in this era of rethinking combatant commands, rather than create a space command, we actually need a broader redefinition almost of strategic command or global command that would be the place where the different agencies work together. And DOD may still be the agency that provides the majority of the personnel and maybe even the top commander, but it's a place where undersecretaries of other agencies spend time, where, you know, dozens of people from the economic agencies are co-located. Maybe it can be done at the Joint Staff of the Pentagon, but that becomes, you know, a DOD inside the building kind of thing. I'm more interested in empowering the other agencies and getting away from the notion that they should be seen as subservient.
It seems to me in listening to you that China and Russia are super differently situated with respect to this kind of economic warfare, in the sense that Russia, economically, Russia is something of a basket case and is mostly resource extraction economy to the extent that it has major economic activity at all, we can exert a lot of pressure on Russia without incurring damage to our own economy at all, although that is less true of Europe because of natural gas stuff. But China, that economic relationship, as we've seen in the trade context, is much more of a economic interdependency relationship. And the ability, as the Chinese economy suffers, the feedback loop to our own economic performance is not zero. And the possibility of economic retaliation is not something you can ignore. I'm curious whether shifting the locus of deterrence and retaliation to the economic sphere is actually whether the calculation that you're making is you'd rather the United States suffer major economic damage over the Senkaku Islands than have a military confrontation over the Senkaku Islands. Is the idea here in part to say, unless the stakes are truly military, let's take it out on each other's employment rather than each other's, physical well-being?
That's pretty well put. I think I should have let you read the draft of the book. I could have used some of your reformulations of my argument because that's very well said. And that I think I would essentially agree with the way you described it. First of all, a very brief note on Russia. I accept and concur with your basic analysis about Russia's economy. One very concrete idea that I propose in the book, however, for how to be even in a stronger economic position vis-a-vis Russia is to use NATO infrastructure funds to subsidize the building of a few more liquefied natural gas terminals in Western Europe so that there are more alternatives to Russian gas. Europe's already in much better shape than it was 10 or 20 years ago in terms of being able to reverse flow in pipelines, have various options for bringing in gas from different places and oil. But we could go further. And it's not going to mean that there's zero economic harm to Europe. They're still going to have to pay higher prices for LNG than they would for Russian gas if we ever get to that point. But I want them to be able to survive a Russian cutoff of gas, which Russia might impose or which we might want to impose. And we want to be in an escalation dominance position, which I think inherently we are. I think ultimately Russia needs the Western European markets more than Western Europe needs their energy, especially if we take a few more steps to make sure there are alternatives. So you're right, China's the harder question. And part of my thinking, again, it depends on the precise case. If the Chinese wind up holding on to one of the eight Senkaku Islands for the next 30 years, but they don't do anything else,
that's a win.
That's a win compared to the scenario that I'm thinking of. It's the least bad outcome. None of these outcomes are meant to be cheery or make your day, but that's once the aggression has happened and the deterrence has failed, that's a win. So for that kind of a scenario, with all due respect to my Japanese friends and your many Japanese followers who listen to Lawfare podcast, there's going to be a part of Japanese territory as they see it that won't be back in their hands indefinitely and maybe ever.
And that would be little different from the Kuril Islands from the Japanese point of view, which they assert sovereignty over and have been in Russian hands since World War II.
And real people live in those islands. So yes, I think that's the kind of thing we would have to say is preferable to even a 10% chance of war escalating to all out US, Japan, China, conventional or nuclear war. So that one I think is to me fairly easy. So what I'm suggesting is we don't need to actually put our foot on China's economic throat the way we're now trying to do with Iran. We don't need to literally drive them completely, to the floor, because if we do that, as the years go by, we'll be doing the same thing to our own economy. Even if we have some slight escalation dominance, some slightly greater resilience, because we are smart enough to not develop further dependencies on the Chinese economy, maybe we even wean ourselves away from some of the dependencies we have now in areas like rare earth metals or certain electronics components, I think we should probably have a concept of putting a ceiling of 50% dependence on China for anything that's strategically important or some figure like that, and use subsidies and other kinds of government incentives to try to broaden supply chain options, both with natural commodities and with components. as a means of making sure we are able to engage in this kind of economic warfare and not lose. So I am worried and interested in all that. But for the smaller issues, I'm prepared to have China pay a price. Yes, we pay a price too. It's not totally unlike what President Trump's doing now with tariffs over the trade issue. Maybe you escalate a bit more than he has, or you sustain it a bit longer. But in a way, not that I usually see him as the lead strategic thinker of his day, but in a way, Donald Trump is showing how you implement this kind of a strategy for very different reasons in his case, and probably ones that are less wise, because I'm suggesting we hold on to these kind of tools for when we really have a major crisis, not for managing sort of a longstanding trade dispute.
At a diffuse trade dispute. I mean, you're describing using tools like this when there is an actual attack on a U.S. ally to whom we have treaty commitments, not a general sense that trade is unfair,
exactly.
Right?
Right. That's right.
All right. So I want to close with one additional question, which is the nature of the asymmetry that you're describing. So both of the countries that we're working with here are major cyber actors with, and particularly Russia, with very refined capabilities in the cyber domain, and who clearly understand that as one of their major asymmetric advantages vis-a-vis the United States. So I think it is really implausible to imagine that, you know, if you had, you know, Senkaku Island number one seized and our strategy were, you know, deploy to the other seven and use major economic pressure as a kind of asymmetric, not merely military response. I think we should expect, if we do that, asymmetric response from either of the countries, whatever country we're talking about, in the cyber domain toward things that we care about a lot, whether it's critical infrastructure here or whether it's, you know, I don't know, they're super creative about, right, political system. You know, the North Koreans, of course, went after Sony. I think both the Russians and Chinese are smarter than that, which are more creative. And so my question is asymmetric. You use asymmetric as a positive, advantageous thing that we can do, but that's a two-edged sword. And so I'm imagining, like, what are the asymmetric responses to our asymmetric response look like, particularly in the cyber domain?
Well, it's a great question. And that's part of why, I'll come back to cyber in a second, but that's part of why I'm interested in the book and thinking through where we get our key intermediate electronics goods and our key commodities, we and our allies, because the most natural thing for Russia or China to do is to cut off certain specific exports in those domains and see how we like it. And I think they probably would do some of that anyway. I just want to make sure they don't have an ace in the hole, that they don't have an ability to find our Achilles heel, because we have hopefully built up some dependency, some alternatives in the supply chain domain, some alternatives in the commodity and mineral and metal domains so that we could actually weather that. Coming back to cyber, you know better than I, there are a few basic principles of cyber attacks that are relevant here. One of them is you probably can hurt somebody a lot. Modern cyber warrior states are pretty good at discovering vulnerabilities and doing nasty things. That's point one. But point two is you yourself don't really know how effective your attack will be until you carry it out, because the system that you're attacking may experience ripple effects as a result of the initial insult you deliver to it, and it's hard to predict what those will be. Three, you don't really know how long it will take the other side to recover. And so four, you certainly can't do a net assessment in advance of what damage you'll cause and how long it will last. These are both pluses and minuses about cyber attacks, because you can always feign lack of advanced foresight about just how bad your attack would be. But also, you may be nervous that you can't really achieve any precise effect, and you may achieve an effect greater than you wanted. And so there's going to be a certain wariness in most cases about high-end cyber attack. But you're right that we should expect it. part of what I'm trying to do with these responses to the scenarios in my book is have a specific enough, precise enough, and proportionate enough response that Russia and China don't really want to go there. Because I can't preclude the possibility. And if they go there, then we'll retaliate. And we'll retaliate with a combination of cyber and potentially other kinds of responses. And no one knows where that world is going. I want to stay away from that world. I want to give everybody as much time to calm down and realize it's not worth military responses, nuclear responses, or even high-end cyber responses. Because when we get into that world, we don't control the escalation. It's what Thomas Schelling used to call the threat that leaves something to chance. And I don't think nuclear-armed superpowers want to get into a realm of the threat that leaves something to chance. I want a specific kind of proportionate response and then put the dilemma back in Beijing or Moscow's hands and brains. What do we do? How much more do we want to escalate? We've already made our point. We took our little piece of land. We stuck it in NATO's face. We stuck it in Japan's face. Now we're suffering some degree of retaliation, but we can live with it. It's no big deal. But it does signal that the West and the United States are resolute enough that we can't keep down this path, keep doing more. So now do we just sit with our initial conquest or do we raise the ante? You and I and no other American, we can't preclude the possibility that Beijing or Moscow will raise the ante in a reckless way. But I want to just slow down that process and give them reason to feel like our response has been proportionate and doesn't necessitate a huge new qualitatively different level of response on their part. And then we'll have to see where it goes.
So if Prime Minister Abe or former Estonian President Tomas Ilves, who is the only head of state who has ever been a guest on the Lawfare podcast, were here, they might listen to you with a little bit of alarm and say, particularly Ilves, right, where you're talking about his sovereign territory, acknowledged, concededly sovereign territory, not some uninhabited rock that's long been disputed. And he might say, what I hear you saying is that there are second-class members of NATO and, you know, you're not talking about Canada. When you're not talking about the UK, you're talking about the frontline states. And a doctrine like this is a doctrine that whispers to Vladimir Putin, it's okay if you take a little bit of Estonia, just don't do too much. What would you say to reassure them?
Well, first, I think you're right that there would be some varying reactions, not all positive, in the Baltic states. But secondly, the Baltic states know full well that they're not defensible right now, especially against these kinds of probing attacks. I was just in Lithuania last month, had a very good trip, and was impressed by what the Lithuanians are doing. But their main brigade, they have two in the army. Brigades are 3,000 or 4,000 soldiers each. They have two to defend all that land, basically the equivalent of Maryland or Iowa, right next to Russia and Belarus. And their main brigade is based in the middle of the country. They don't even have a forward defense of their own territory, and they don't have minefields on the eastern or western sides of their country. The east is the border with Belarus. The west is the border with Kaliningrad, Russia. And so implicitly, they are imagining a defense in depth, a flexible defense, a defense that prioritizes the cities over each inch of their own territory. And in a sense, that's what I'm saying too. So I would try to turn it back on them and say the only practical way to defend your country is to make, first of all, make it undigestible and whole for Russia if they ever got overly ambitious. And then secondly, have clever responses that acknowledge the reality, the sheer geography. Russia's Western Military District is right next to these countries. It's open farmland. It's low hills, some forest. It's not defensible in each and every town. And rather than pretend to ourselves that it is, we should think about different types of responses for different types of scenarios. Now, Russia should never be promised the only response will be economic. I'm not suggesting that we rule out the possibility of a military response. And maybe we wind up attacking a few little Russian assets somewhere else. Maybe we grab a sliver of Russia, you know? I mean, I don't want to rule out some worries on the part of Moscow. All I'm suggesting is that the more credible overall NATO and EU response is actually to prevent further Russian transgression even further into the Baltics and then slap economic pain on them, the likes of which they haven't seen even after the aggression against Ukraine in 2014, and the likes of which they will probably not want to withstand for too long before reversing the aggression.
The book is The Senkaku Paradox, Risking Great Power War Over Small Stakes. Mike O'Hanlon, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks very much to you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. And once again, this episode is a good illustration of what we mean when we say produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. The guest is a Brookings scholar. The book is published by the Brookings Institution Press. All the work in question is Brookings' work. We're on the fourth floor of the Brookings Institution. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our audio engineer this week was Matthew Kahn. You need to do your part to promote the Brookings Institution and the Lawfare Podcast, so tweet about us, share us on Facebook, and leave us a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution service you use. And don't forget to pin us on Pinterest. I've never been on Pinterest, so what do I know? But there you go. In case what's missing from your life is Lawfare merch, you should go to thelawfarestore.com because you know that what's missing from your life is a new Lawfare lapel pin. Our music is, as ever, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.